Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
In recent times, the question of Irish military neutrality has come under increased focus. International destabilisation, the invasion of Ukraine, war in the Middle East, American foreign policy being dramatically redefined, and the increased chorus about ramping up defence spending and military cooperation within the EU have all led to questions around whether our status as a neutral country needs to evolve. So where does the debate now sit? And historically, just what has Irish neutrality meant? Joining me to discuss this, Diarmaid Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD. Good morning to you, Diarmaid.
Morning, Phil.
Let us go back to what it is that the Founding Fathers intended. There they were, sitting outclassed and outgunned by David Lloyd George and Winston Churchill on the other side of the table from Arthur Griffith and Michael Collins. And Griffith hadn't even read any of the defence papers before the negotiations began.
No, and Arthur Griffith later recalled that we tried neutrality, but it didn't work. And he said they were sitting on a rock, the British negotiating team, when it came to crown and empire. That rock was made of crown and empire. And what the Irish negotiators were being told was that they could forget about any defence policy papers or any idea of an independent foreign policy because Britain had to have the control it needed to secure its own defence. Now, that's a crucial reminder that this question of neutrality has always been about geography as well as history. You obviously have this desire being expressed by Michael Collins, another negotiator, that we would like to be permanently neutral. But that was not something that was going to be tolerated by Britain because it was thinking of its strategic imperial interests. And even the previous year, Eamon de Valera had crisscrossed America to make the case for a sovereign Irish Republic, and he was trying to convince America that that would not threaten their relationship with Britain. And he got himself into hot water by suggesting that a future British-Irish relationship could be akin to that between Cuba and America, that Cuba, in other words, would not allow itself to be strategically used to destabilise or attack America, and that Ireland would take the same approach in relation to Britain. That caused a lot of consternation amongst Irish-American groups. And it was also, though, a revelation of his strategic and quite nuanced thinking around the idea of external association. In other words, we have to recognise the reality of us being beside this much more powerful offshore island, and we have to recognise that we cannot be used as a base to cause problems for Britain. So in a way, you know, there was a degree of realism there, you could say, from the outset, even before the foundation of the state. There was a realpolitik at play there.
It was, ultimately, wasn't it, a very, very practical decision. But they were able to, at the foundation of the state, and declare neutrality, they were able to use it, did they not, to say, look, we have to be a part of this Commonwealth because that's in the terms of the treaty, but we're not going to be a part of your empire and your wars of aggression. That's what neutrality means.
And that is the whole point, of course, about trying to conceive of and implement an independent foreign policy within the empire. And in a way, you know, De Valera proved the veracity of those who had signed the treaty, suggesting that this could be the beginning of further independence. You're doing it within the Commonwealth, of course, until a later stage. But what De Valera was really seeking was ultimately the return of the treaty ports, because that left Ireland in a position where it couldn't claim meaningful sovereignty. In other words, Britain had access to naval facilities in Ireland, did not permit Ireland to have its own navy. That didn't happen formally until 1946, when Ireland had its own navy. And of course, the winning back of the treaty ports in 1938, the timing crucially significant given the gathering clouds of war in Europe, the treaty ports were returned to Ireland. That meant that De Valera could implement an independent foreign policy. So that's really the crucial test. Here is the first opportunity to meaningfully implement an independent foreign policy. And it's a very, very tricky balancing act.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. 1920s, we're up and running. We are a state, but neutrality isn't this big principle of remaining non-aligned. it's really more a useful way of not reopening and relitigating the civil war.
Oh, absolutely. And
you,
I mean, you keep
you don't want to be taken sides with anybody.
And you also keep your defence forces at a minimum. You know, I mean, the Irish Army was bloated. The Free State Army was bloated by 1923 at the end of the Civil War. And the call is for demobilisation. You've got to shrink this army because we are not intending to be involved in any kind of conflict. And the army was small. The Department of Finance, of course, was quite pleased at the idea that it didn't have to spend on defence. It had enough on its plate at that time. And there was also the contested legitimacy of the state. So trying to demilitarise that state was a priority as well. And again, the idea was that the Irish would be involved in friendly international cooperation and urging peaceful resolution to international conflict. And it's one of the reasons why they were keen to get involved in the League of Nations. A, to establish themselves as a small voice on an international stage, but B, to be involved in an organisation that actually promoted international cooperation as opposed to conflict.
1937, Spanish Civil War, government gets itself in a little bit of a tizzy over that. In fact, there's a piece of legislation, the Spanish Civil War brackets non-intervention close brackets Act 1937. That wasn't, though, was it? Again, a statement about the principle of being non-aligned. That was about dealing with our baby fascist blue shirts.
Well, I mean, Irish people made up their own minds about which side of the Spanish Civil War they were on. And of course, they fought on both sides. Those who fought on the Republican side are much better remembered. But again, it was also about De Valera and that government of the 1930s seeking to establish a line of independent foreign policy thinking, that we do have a distinct foreign policy, and that we are in the business of non-intervention, and we are not going to be taking sides. And I mean, you know, given what was at stake in the 1930s, they could be tricky enough diplomatic positions to take. But De Valera was also very disillusioned with the disintegration of the League of Nations and the authority of the League of Nations. And he was somebody who decried, when he had the form of the League of Nations, the failure of the larger powers to take into account the concerns of the smaller powers and effectively to ignore them. And again, this is all heading in a particular direction by the end of that decade.
Yeah, I want to skip, though, over the Second World War, because we've had that conversation so many, many times before, and move on to the Cold War. Now, we couldn't have joined NATO, could we? When you consider that one of the principal members of NATO was somebody that we were going to share a border with and a contested border with.
Well, there were those who argued that we could join NATO if we were free. But being free, of course, meant the end of partition. Sean McBride was Minister for External Affairs in 1948 when that new coalition government came in. And he was open to the idea of NATO membership if partition was ended. And if that was not going to happen, Ireland couldn't possibly align itself with a military power that was occupying part of its island. So what he suggested as an alternative was that Ireland would have a bilateral defence arrangement with the United States. And you mightn't be surprised to learn that the United States was not remotely interested in such an arrangement, and it certainly wasn't a priority. And there's still, of course, there's that legacy of the Second World War and the anger that existed in America about Irish neutrality. But, so NATO was not something that was regarded as remotely feasible while Ireland remained partitioned. But it wasn't ruled out. And I mean, those who were talking about it.
But my point is that we didn't remain outside of it on point of principle of non-alignment.
No, this is the crucial point about this historic debate about neutrality. If you trawl through the Dáil debates going back to those earlier decades, you will find people saying, we would have the same inducements as other countries to join NATO, you know, if Ireland was not partitioned. We are not in principle against the idea of aligning ourselves. And of course, Ireland did join the United Nations in 1955.
Well, now, hang on a second. We did a lot worse than that before that. When you consider that Liam Cosgrave, when Minister for External Affairs, started handing intelligence files to the CIA.
There has never been a period of foreign policy where there was not some covert sharing of information. And again, this goes back to
the right side.
This goes back to the idea, the late historian Dermot Keogh describes the shadow language and shape-shifting that was associated with Irish foreign policy and Irish defence and security policy, the sharing of intelligence. And sometimes that intelligence on the Irish side could be quite sophisticated, but that you use it in a particular way whilst not compromising yourself publicly. There are agreements that perhaps go on in private. There's often been reference, for example, to an agreement with Britain regarding the Royal Air Force. and its access to Irish skies, and of course its role, or the role it might play if the defence of Ireland and by extension Britain was threatened.
I know, but there's such huge hypocrisy here, because when you consider at that time, James Dillon lost out on the leadership of Fine Gael, did he not?
Because, as a lone voice.
Because he was against our neutrality and wanted to take a principled stand on it. But my
Well, God. Here's the moral debate, Philip, and this has always been a part of this. You know, was there a moral obligation on the Irish state to join the Allies, given what was at stake in relation to international conflict? James Dillon did find himself very much an isolated figure. But there were also, again, going back to this idea of people making their own decisions, there were many thousands, of course, who volunteered for service in British Army uniform, Irish people in both the First World War and the Second World War. But yes, James Dillon found himself in a very difficult position politically. He did recover from it ultimately. But again, you had
it's,
this.
It's worth, though, just taking a little aside here, because one of the best ding-dongs in the Dáil ever between James Dillon and Eamon de Valera. De Valera was accusing him of being a bit of a Brit-licker because of his stance on neutrality. And Dillon shoots back at him, my forefathers were fighting wars on the continent when your people were bashing banjos, bartering budgerigars on the back streets of Barcelona.
Isn't it a reminder, Philip, that the standard of oratory in the Dáil has declined dramatically?
James Dillon, well, at least the standard of alliteration.
James Dillon was, well able to defend his position, and he continued to do so in the decades afterwards. But that debate that's going on then in the 1950s and the 1960s is also shifting in a direction towards greater European cooperation. And that raised the thorny question of Irish military alignment or not again. And if you look at 1962, for example, when Ireland is pushing the idea as aggressively as it can that it should be considered a member or a candidate for membership of the European Economic Community, Sean Lamass made no bones around the idea that we would be prepared to yield even the technical label of neutrality. We will go as far as this field takes us in military policy. And isn't it interesting that he used the technical label of neutrality? Neutrality wasn't part of the Irish constitution. It wasn't a constitutional issue in the way it is, for example, in Austria, where it was enshrined in the constitution in 1955.
And didn't Garrett Fitzgerald say of that period that both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in the 70s and early 80s had more or less accepted that membership of the EU or the EEC was going to involve some kind of a commitment to common defence?
That is absolutely clear again from the Dáil debates.
But it was Charlie Haughey playing politics with it then in the 80s changed that.
Yeah, you could play politics with this at different stages, particularly if it suited your Anglo-Irish agenda, for example. But there was always an acceptance that if this field of European cooperation goes into the defence field and military alignment, we will sign up for that. And they went further and said, we have no traditional policy of neutrality in this country. In other words, we react to circumstances as they evolve. And we're still today talking about the evolution of Irish neutrality.
We have to, in the minute or so that we have remaining, though, acknowledge that this technical, strategic, perhaps even cynical approach of our leaders to the issue of neutrality is very much out of step with where people's hearts and minds are at, and particularly in that period, the 60s, 70s and 80s, when neutrality was defined around Irish peacekeeping commitments on the international stage.
Yes, and I mean, we've had over 75,000 individual tours, peacekeeping tours, since 1958. And 88 people have lost their lives. And people are very attuned to what that involved, that we could make a contribution in this way. And it's not about cynicism. It's also about small states not being able to afford to have one big grand design when it comes to their foreign policy. That's what the history of this debate would suggest, that you do need to be nimble. Sometimes you need to be canny. Sometimes you need to be hypocritical and self-serving. But you also have to be conscious of the public attachment that exists towards the idea of being able to exercise a degree of independence as a small state.
But we have never put our money where our mouth is at any point and created a proper army.
Well, I mean, the Commission on the Defence Forces uses the word urgent 38 times, the most recent one, in relation to underfunding. We have, I think, an expenditure well below the European average when it comes to defence. And again, there's a long history behind that. Not even 0.5% of GDP, the European average would be 1.74%. So you're talking about expenditure of billions if you're to bring that up to the European average. But it also raises the question, and again, our own president has been vocal about this, are you then burying yourself in someone else's agenda? You know, are you going to get to the stage where you are pumping billions into defence spending as part of a path towards inevitable involvement in a common European defence policy? And that does raise constitutional and, for many people, moral as well as political questions.
If only we had the luxury of setting the international agenda, but I don't think people in the Kremlin or Washington are going to allow us much further or greater influence on that one. Dermot Ferriter, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Let's take a break.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.